This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Africa's biggest refugee crisis is getting bigger by the day. Thousands of South Sudanese are crossing into Uganda as violence and food insecurity ravages their home country.
That's VOA East Africa correspondent Jill Craig reporting. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, seven people are dead in the Somali capital Mogadishu today after a car bomb explodes outside a newly opened coffee shop. Another earthquake hits Botswana, and Italy's foreign ministry summons a Swiss ambassador to Rome over the nighttime closure of three border areas.
We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, seven people are dead in the Somali capital Mogadishu today after a car bomb exploded outside a newly opened coffee shop. The cafe is located near several government ministries. No one has claimed responsibility yet, but Al-Shabaab militants are suspected in the latest car bombing in the capital. The Associated Press reports the militants have denounced new Somali-American President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmaajo and have warned Somalis against supporting him.
Conflict, drought, potential famine, malnutrition, and a cholera epidemic all are contributing to Somalia's humanitarian crisis. Among the many agencies trying to help is the UN Development Program. George Conway is the country director. He spoke to VOA's Joe DeCapua about the crisis.
The current drought situation has been quite protracted and has been going on for well over a year now, going back over three rainy seasons, and none of which materialized. And so this has been a slow build problem. It was in January, February this year that the UN officially came out with food security numbers that indicated the risk of a significant famine based on the trajectory. There was a pre-famine alert, but it warned that if that trajectory continued, we would likely very possibly be seeing famine conditions come May, June. The drought has been affecting the Horn of Africa more generally, goes across the Sahel into West Africa, and certainly into the Gulf. The Secretary General has issued a warning for four countries in particular, for northern Nigeria, for South Sudan, for Somalia, and for Yemen. It's becoming fairly desperate at this stage. In Somalia, we have over 500,000 people who are newly displaced since late last year. These are people from rural areas whose livestock have died, whose crops have failed, pastoralists and agro-pastoralists, and are now migrating to urban centers. And these numbers have been on an upward trajectory in recent weeks and months. There's fairly significant migration into the urban centers now.
When you talk about pre-famine conditions, can you give us an example of what a typical family on the move is facing when they're in a pre-famine condition?
For an average family, this means if you're a pastoralist, if you make your life off of herding goats or herding camels, that your animals have effectively died as a result of lack of water and food, are you no longer to make a livelihood from that? The rural areas, many of which still in southern Somalia, are affected by Al-Shabaab, are very difficult for international community to access. So support is not always readily available in those areas, and it causes people to have to move to particular urban centers, the state capitals in particular. If you're a farmer or an agro-pastoralist, your crops have failed for two seasons in a row now, and it means that all of your family-level coping strategies that kept people going previously have been eroded away to such a degree but they have no option to move to centers where they're hopeful that they can receive assistance.
Is the UNDP also involved in trying to slow down the cholera epidemic?
And it has gotten quite worrying in recent weeks, with over 20,000 cases reported by WHO now and over 400 deaths. There are specialized agencies within the UN country team, WHO in particular, UNICEF, and a number of larger NGOs that are very much seized through this. The government is also very proactively trying to work on the situation and has deployed teams of doctor volunteers at the federal government level and the state government down into the most affected areas to try to rein the epidemic in a little bit.
Do you have enough money to deal with this crisis? And if not, how much do you need?
The appeal that was issued amounted to $825 million that was put out at the beginning of this year. Donors have been forthcoming. Over 50% of that has been committed now, over $400 million. But frankly, it's still not enough. The UN and partners and the government itself at different levels are really trying to scale up a response over these next months. But in humanitarian partners in the UN and in civil society have been scaling up their programs and have been expanding assistance in areas as rapidly as possible. There's at least 1.9 million people have now received cash assistance to help them weather through this current situation, but it's simply not enough. The number of people that were targeted for acute food insecurity and at risk of starvation was about 3 million people, and you know the numbers are still shy of that. But the overall number of people that would require some type of support from the humanitarian community was just about 6 million people, so there's still a long ways to go.
Does the UNDP have any particular concerns about Somalia in the months and years ahead?
It's really incumbent on all of us to not just take a short-term emergency view to the current context, but look at the causes of the current types of crisis that we're seeing and to look for developmental responses to those that can build the country's resilience. Droughts will always happen in Somalia. Whether or not those droughts turn into famine is a result of a range of factors related to how well governance functions, how good security is, how much food is being produced locally and in the markets, and the very good work that can be done for the future. A drought of this nature does not necessitate a famine. A famine is as much human caused as anything else.
George Conway is country director in Somalia for the UN Development Programme. He spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
Africa's biggest refugee crisis is getting bigger by the day. From northern Uganda, VOA's Jill Craig reports thousands of South Sudanese are crossing into Uganda as violence and food insecurity ravages their home country.
The buses keep rolling in, bringing more South Sudanese from border points in northern Uganda to refugee settlements, their new homes for the foreseeable future. In Busia, only a short footbridge separates South Sudan from Uganda. The newcomers often arrive malnourished, thirsty, and exhausted. 30-year-old Abui John Tadeo was a mathematics teacher before he fled on foot with his wife and three children. He arrived at the border 2 hours ago and is waiting for a bus to take him and his family to the Kaluba collection point.
I need to live here because there's a lot of shooting, looting. So we are tired, that's why we need to live here, so that we rest a little bit.
Like Tadeo, many of these new arrivals are from Yei and other places in the Equatoria region, which has experienced intense fighting. More than 816,000 South Sudanese refugees have come to Uganda fleeing violence. Susan Gunay also comes from Yei, and she and her family now stay in the Mvepi refugee settlement. She says they came to Uganda because life is hard and risky, and they will not go back because people are killing us, chasing us to the bush, burning us inside our houses. She says in Uganda they have a secure life. Esther Akujo is a 24-year-old refugee who brought her three children to Uganda alone. Her husband was arrested before they left. She says there is no more food, people are starving, and there is no medical access. There are no roads for the food to get into town. She says when people bring food from rural areas, armed men collect it and the people in town suffer. While life at home was difficult, Rose Nyanga says so was the journey to Uganda. She says for 14 days they walked day and night, surviving on wild fruits and stagnant water. Fabi and Richard Wani trekked for 10 days with his wife, children, and a group of orphans from Yei, but he says he still has hope for his country.
I'm looking for the future of the country, and for us to achieve the peace, we need to be godly fearing people, and the leaders should also accept their mistakes and they see the suffering of their own citizens so that the future of the country will be very bright.
Refugees in the Ugandan settlements are given a 50 meter by 50 meter plot of land to be used for shelter and cultivation, in addition to food, water, non-food items, health services, and children's education. Jill Craig, VOA News, in northern Uganda.
Botswana was hit with another earthquake early this morning, two after a strong quake shook the country. There are no reports of casualties or major damage. The U.S. Geological Survey says today's earthquake had a magnitude of 5.0. It occurred at 2:55 a.m. local time, about 255 kilometers north of the capital, Gaborone. On Monday, an earthquake measuring 6.5 hit Botswana, but it was also felt in neighboring countries. It occurred in a remote area about 240 kilometers northwest of the capital. No deaths were reported there. A smaller quake was also reported Monday morning in northwestern South Africa.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
At 15 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Seven people are dead in the Somali capital Mogadishu today after a car bomb exploded outside a newly opened coffee shop. Another earthquake hits Botswana, and thousands of South Sudanese continue to cross into Uganda as violence and hunger rage in their home country. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The Italian Foreign Ministry summoned the Swiss ambassador to Rome yesterday over the nighttime closure of three border areas separating Italy and Switzerland. Critics say it's an attempt to stop the flow of migrants into Switzerland. However, the Swiss diplomat stressed the closures are temporary. He says they are part of joint efforts with Italian security forces to improve security along the border. Josephine McKenna is following developments in Rome. She first updates us on the Swiss border crossings and reports on a Libyan tribal leader who's offering to help stop human trafficking through southern Libya.
Well, this has happened in the last few days, and the Italian Foreign Ministry on Tuesday summoned the Swiss ambassador to Rome, Giancarlo Kessler, over the nighttime closure of three border areas separating Italy and Switzerland. And the Foreign Ministry released a statement stressing that Mr. Kessler said this was a temporary measure, an experimental measure, a way to regulate the border area and ensure continuing cooperation between the security forces of both countries. But the Italian government took the opportunity to repeat its demand to keep these borders operating, to allow the flow of workers across the border, to repeat its demand that criminal record checks applied to Italian workers are suspended. This is an interesting dispute between the two countries. Swiss newspapers, incidentally, are saying these closures are designed to cut cross-border crime, particularly burglaries, but it's not really clear whether it's targeting Italian workers who cross the border regularly or whether it's really going after the waves of migrants who may be trying to cross that border illegally.
Also, I understand that the Swiss side acknowledged that it's a violation of the existing agreement on free movement. So what is going to happen then?
The Swiss government seems to be assuring the Italians that it's only going to last for a few months until they can stabilize the security situation. Local mayors on the Italian side of the border are very angry, and security officials on the other side of the Swiss border in the area known as Ticino acknowledged that break-ins dropped in the past year. So it's difficult to say how this will unfold, but certainly it's another indication that Italians are very concerned that they're bearing the burden of this wave of migrants that are coming into Italy, and they certainly want to ensure that some of the other countries surrounding Italy, like France, Switzerland, Austria, share a bit more of the burden. That's unlikely to happen when countries like Switzerland take this kind of action.
Also, a Libyan tribal leader, Mohamed Hey Sandu, he is pledging to help stop the human trafficking through southern Libya. So how was he intending on doing this?
Well, leaders from the Tuareg, Tuvu, and other tribes met in Rome on Sunday and basically gave assurances that they could lock down Libya's southern border with Niger and stop this flow of sub-Saharan migrants. But they want to do that in exchange for spending and financing from the Italian government. So they're willing to collaborate. In an interview, the Tupou leader, Mohamed Haistandu, told one Italian daily newspaper that he was pledging to stop human trafficking through southern Libya, providing the Italians delivered on their promises. And that is to finance infrastructure, to provide finance to develop their very fragile economy. And he stressed that in that area, many people are struggling, particularly since the fall of the Gaddafi regime. Up to 15% of local adults, he said, work in the people smuggling industry. It's interesting that these negotiations are taking place. It's a very long border, as we know, 3,000 miles or 5,000 kilometres. Whether one tribe or several tribes can actually make a difference and stop the flow of migrants is really quite an ambitious goal, I think, at this point.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
The group Human Rights Watch is raising concerns about what it calls a spate of killings in central Mali this year. It says Islamist groups, self-defense militias, and some government soldiers are involved. At least 52 deaths have been reported and about 10,000 people displaced. HRW's Associate Africa Director, Corinne Dufka, says nearly 60 witnesses were interviewed for the report. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua about the growing violence in Mali.
You'll recall that a peace agreement in 2015 and before that, the French-led intervention in 2013 were envisioned to restore peace and stability and government rule to the north. But in the meantime, from early 2015, the armed Islamists started moving south and establishing a presence in the central Mopti and Segu region. Now, over the past few years, they have increasingly targeted government representatives. Now, this has in turn elevated ethnic tension because members of the Bambara and Dogon communities have organized themselves to defend themselves against these Islamists and their numerous assassinations. In mid-February, the Islamists killed a Bambara shopkeeper, and this set off reprisals by the Dozos, who are a group of Bambara who are organized to protect their communities, in which they killed at least 21 members of the Pul community. They set upon seven villages, burning them and killing civilians, including children. In addition to that, we have also had the assassination of, so far this year, of three government representatives, we believe, by the armed Islamists, and then a number of killings by the Malian army in the context of counterterrorism operations.
This almost sounds like Central African Republic when you had the Seleka rebels and then you had the anti-Balaka militias forming to wage revenge attacks.
Well, there are some similarities. Now, what's very interesting about all of this is that the armed Islamists are targeting their recruitment efforts on the Pul community, and they are taking advantage of a number of issues, including government corruption, abuses by the security forces, problems with banditry, and they are in many ways trying to address these problems as an effort to increase their resonance within the Pul community, and that is serving to seriously elevate tension.
So is Human Rights Watch making any recommendations regarding what to do about this violence?
Yes, we are. We are asking the government to investigate all of these killings. To their credit, they initiated a commission of inquiry in early March into the killings in Cay Messina, which is the place around which the killing of the over 20 Pul occurred. We're urging them to investigate the killings by all of these alleged perpetrators so that villagers and civilians from all different groups feel as though they are being listened to. We are also urging a parliamentary commission of inquiry into the issues which lie at the root of these problems, because this isn't the first very violent spate of intercommunal violence we have seen in Mali. Last year in May, there was another one in which, again, over 20 Pul villagers were killed, again, by Dozo militia.
That's Human Rights Watch Associate Africa Director Corinne Dufka. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua.
When people think of osteoporosis, they usually think of women, and women do get it more often than men, but men can get osteoporosis as well. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on a study about men and bone health at the University of Missouri.
Osteoporosis literally means porous bones. The bones can become so thin in places that even a simple stretch can result in a bone fracture. Everyone's bones weaken with age, but not everyone gets osteoporosis. Risk factors are smoking, drinking, having a family history of osteoporosis, and leading a sedentary lifestyle. 200 million people have osteoporosis worldwide, and that number is expected to shoot up dramatically as populations age the world over. The International Osteoporosis Foundation projects that the global incidence of hip fracture will double by 2025, and it will nearly triple by 2050, when it will affect more than 6 million people. In Asia, by 2050, hip fractures could account for 45% of all such fractures in the world. Osteoporosis can cause chronic pain, and some fractures, especially hip fractures, can be fatal. Even active people can have low bone density, which can lead to osteoporosis. Every week, Dean Hargett bikes more than 160 kilometers. It's good for his heart, but it doesn't do much for his bones. Hargett was shocked to discover he has low bone density.
It alarmed me. I don't want to have fragile bones. I want to be able to be, you know, strong and healthy the rest of my life.
A decrease in bone density could lead to osteoporosis. Pam Hinton is an associate professor at the University of Missouri, where she conducts research on nutrition and physical activity on bone health.
About 1 in 4 men will have osteoporotic-related fracture in their lifetime.
Over a 12-month period, Hinton studied how resistance and jump training exercises affected the bone health for men ages 25 to 60. The results showed these exercises did more than just slow the rate of bone loss.
We actually saw an increase in bone mass with either type of exercise, so that was a very encouraging and exciting result.
The exercise decreases the level of sclerostin, a protein that slows bone growth. At the same time, it increases a hormone that promotes bone growth. Hargett now knows he has to do more than cycle and swim to strengthen his bones.
Don't take your bone strength for granted. They can wither just like any other part of your body. Use it or lose it.
Weightlifting is now a part of Hargett's regular exercise routine. Besides getting the right kind of exercise, getting enough vitamin D and calcium can also keep bones strong. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Take your peek. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss Against All Odds, a book written by Cameroonian lawyer Angela Kwemo. It's a practical guide to making the most of your God-given talents and using them to better yourself, your country, Africa, and the human race. That's all on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.